I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're joined by, I would say, one of the foremost legal commentators in the United States, one of the foremost legal scholars on freedom of speech and on the Constitution and its meaning, particularly the Constitution's understanding of liberty. That is Professor Jonathan Turley of George Washington Law School. Jonathan, welcome back to The American Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, The Indispensable Right, Free Speech in an Age of Rage, is understandably and rightfully making a big splash. It's a terrific book. I want to commend it to our listeners again. It deserves to be read widely by citizens, and it's written in such a way, I think, right, deliberately, that the general public can read it and profit by it.
I hope so. You know, this is an effort to explain the personalities and periods that help shape our view of free speech. And these are interesting people. They're what George Bernard Shaw called unreasonable people, people who frankly wouldn't shut up. But they had a huge, perhaps oversized effect on who we are as a people. But the book really explores areas that are not normally part of a First Amendment book. It looks at everything from art to science and on why human beings need free speech. And it sort of goes to this notion that free speech is a natural right, in my view. And it's one of the reasons why we're still struggling. Because early in our republic, we had this clarity that free speech was viewed as a gift from God by the framers. It was a very Lockean idea that to be fully human, God gave you certain rights. In certain capacities, and one of them is expression, and you need it to be fully human.
A part of the, of course, talking about freedom of speech, as you point out in the book, this is also, and you've certainly written since the release of the book, on its freedom of, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press.
Right.
Okay. And the book talks a little bit about the not only speaking sentiments, but publishing sentiments.
Right.
And you have certainly written extensively on media and the press today. What is the advantage of a robust fourth estate, the media?
You know, it's the press aspect of the First Amendment is fascinating because we didn't have anything that people would recognize today as reporters or journalists. When Burke in London referred to the reporters as the fourth estate sitting up there in the Parliament, he was referring to existing newspapers in London. But at the beginning of our republic, the biggest concern over free speech was the licensing of publications. Many people were reading pamphleteers. Many of them, there were papers that had been established in the Republic. They were largely very opinionated papers. And I think that you would, in many ways, see new media today as a return to where we were in the Republic. But media is very important to us. The press is very important. You know, they have saved our bacon historically. Mm-hmm. You know, the government is a very poor steward of itself. It rarely is as hard on itself as it is on other people. It's been the press that has forced these scandals to come forward, incredibly important scandals from Watergate to the Pentagon Papers. But we are also seeing a change in journalism. And there is a movement of the public away from mainstream media. And it's due to a number of factors, but one of them, I think, is the embracing of mainstream media, of what I call advocacy journalism in the book.
Yes.
And so J schools, or journalism schools today, now teach young reporters that they need to give up objectivity and neutrality, and they need to frame the news to be advocates. And you see that all around you. And the result is that the public is walking away. Recently, the new CEO at Washington Post came in because the Washington Post has lost $77 million wow. last year. They've lost half their readership. And he came in and said, look, we've lost half our readership. And this is a direct quote. He said, nobody's reading your stuff. That's a direct quote from the CEO.
Really?
And the response of the reporters was they wanted him fired instead of saying, wow, we're sawing at the branch we're sitting on, right? But in some ways, as I wrote about in a column recently, journalism has become this sort of ship of fools, you know, that readership revenues are falling. People don't want their stuff. The whole idea of let's go Brandon, that was a criticism of the media more than Biden. It was a criticism because you had a reporter saying something that was not true and you could see it wasn't true. And so the sort of let's go Brandon movement in some ways really captures this shift.
So when you write, you have written recently, as you say, that you actually say it's pretty stark wording. The mainstream media, the legacy media, is in free fall.
It is. And you take a look, we have outlets that are failing. You have the Washington Post that brought in these people. You have some major outlets that have basically closed up. Many of them have abandoned print. They're trying to go at it with digital alone. Local media is doing a little better than national media. But you have the rise of new media. And we have a case that just went to the Supreme Court involving a woman who is a social media journalist along the border. And what's fascinating, what I wrote in that column was to my friends in mainstream media, you're looking at the face of new media. That is, this woman who is calls herself the tattooed lady and the crazy lady, she has a huge following. And so people are beginning to reach out to these different voices.
So it's in free fall in both in the sense, as you're suggesting, both in the terms of its readership, it's just plummeting, but also it is no longer doing what you think journalism should be doing. That what the purpose of the freedom of the press is, what the freedom is there for, is not really being realized.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, I've worked for NBC twice, CBS twice, Fox, BBC. I've also written for most of the major newspapers, and I've been doing that for 30 years. I can't believe the change that I've witnessed in media. And in some cases, we won't go back. People are now more siloed. They want to get their news from, to some degree, an echo chamber. But that doesn't mean that even with a slant of a network that you can't maintain journalistic integrity. And it's something that I've pointed out to media groups is that I really like my former networks, and I still do have a lot of friends there. Mm-hmm. But I've actually, challenged them and said, more Democrats watch Fox News than they do CNN and MSNBC, certainly CNN. And what I've asked them is why?
Yeah, why is that?
Right, why is that? And I think the answer is that they can see stories on Fox that they won't see on those other programs, stories from the southern border, stories that mean something to them, things like transgender issues, things like that sort. The whole advocacy journalism thing, in part, is to downplay things that you don't think the public should be talking about. Well, they will talk about it. They'll go to social media, or they'll find a source like Fox News. And you look at the numbers of Fox News, and it is pretty daunting. I mean, you're talking about viewer numbers that used to only be associated with networks like CBS, ABC. You have these shows that are now competing with network shows. I mean, you have Gutfeld, for example, that's beating some of these late night shows. That mm-hmm. would have been unthinkable when I used to work for at CBS or NBC. And what I've always asked my friends is, you're not even curious. That's what I find strange. That's why I think this is a ship of fools, is that you're not even curious why that's happening. I mean, you're watching this industry decline, and there's not much of an interest to understanding the viewers. Papers like Washington Post, New York Times have basically written off half the country. And that's a heck of a market.
approach, right? You cut your market in half, and then you struggle to maintain what you have in that half, and it's not working.
Another thing that you've written about, you talk about in the book, but you've also written about more extensively is, and you mentioned it, alluded to it briefly, is in freedom of the press, it being exercised more broadly today by citizen journalists. And this idea that to be the press no longer means you have to work for CBS or Fox.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about the rise of the citizen journalists and what has meant for American law and public life.
Yeah, I talk about that in The Indispensable Right because one of the things I find fascinating about these trend lines is that we're in many ways returning home. I mean, this is where we began as a republic. We began with people like Tom Paine writing Common Sense, pamphleteers. People are returning to citizen journalism. And the internet and social media has really allowed that to an extent that is unprecedented. And so people now are very sort of are very skeptical consumers. They usually have multiple sources of media. Many years ago, I remember I was blogging, and I usually blog at like 5 in the morning. And so I'm usually typing, and my kids would go to school. And I remember two of my boys came down on their way to school and said, "What are you writing on?" And I said, "Oh, it's just something for the blog. It's sort of a quirky story." And one of them said, "But is it true?" And I remember being really confused. This was many years ago. And I said, "Why? This came from a main source." And he says, "Yeah, but is it true?" And I remember thinking about that because when I was his age, I would never have gotten a story from like Walter Cronkite and thought, "Is it true?"
Right.
So in some ways, this generation is skeptical, but they may be more sophisticated than the older generation. They don't really trust news as much, and they get multiple sources for news, and that includes social media.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
So with the proliferation of social media, citizen journalists who have millions and millions of views and followers, the state of the law on freedom of the press for people like citizen journalists, where are we with that? Has the law kept pace, and has our understanding of the Constitution and freedom of the press kept pace with this new media?
Well, that is still being worked out. That's what makes this recent Supreme Court case interesting. You have this woman who was arrested because she got non-public information from a police officer, and she said, "That's what journalists do." And I got the information, I ran the information, and the prosecutors tended not to treat her as a journalist. The court did, and say, "Look, this is a social media journalist." And one of the objections that a lot of us had is that if what she did was unlawful, then what New York Times or Washington Post does every day is unlawful. So what is a journalist is still something that's being struggled with by journalists as well as by the courts. I think courts have no choice but to expand the definition. The problem is that if everyone's a journalist, then is no one a journalist? If everyone's a journalist, is no one a journalist?
Right.
And for courts, they're like, "Well, does that mean that everyone gets journalistic privileges?" Now, the actual fact is that there are very few journalistic privileges that in some ways remain. You had cases like the Food Lion case is a good example, where the court rejected any journalistic privilege of these journalists who went undercover to reveal stuff about Food Lion. And the court said, look, you don't have any special privilege to lie to Food Lion to get them to hire you and get into areas that they wouldn't go into. So the level of privilege for journalists is not robust to begin with after a lot of these cases. But then you have problems like shield laws. So you have state shield laws that protect journalists. Will that include social media journalists and new media journalists? And my guess is that you're going to have to eventually, because if you take a look at that woman in the Supreme Court case, she is a following larger than her local newspaper. So it makes it sort of a weird thing that you would give protections for like shield laws to the local paper, but not to someone who has like twice the following and readership.
So it's almost as though press is being recognized more not as who you are, but what the activity you're doing.
That's right. And the internet has empowered people. And that's one of the reasons why I've resisted efforts to censor the internet, And I talk about this in The Indispensable Right, because the internet was the greatest invention for free speech and the media since the printing press. And it, just like the printing press, it revolutionized those fields. And what's interesting is that when people today talk about, well, the internet's this dangerous thing and it's going to threaten your lives and livelihoods, it's almost identical to what, for example, British governors said at the start of the Republic. You had, in my book, I talk about how one governor wrote to London and said, thank God we don't have any of those printing presses here in the United States. This would be really horrible. And you hear the same type of thing with this new, the social media and how horrible and dangerous it is. It's, yes, there are dangers on the internet. Yes, we have to be serious about dealing with those. But this is a tremendous vehicle of free speech. It empowers people to an extent. And you're really seeing that with the media, that one of the things that bothers them the most is that they're losing control of the narrative. And, you know, I wrote a column actually today that said something sort of interesting about, a poll said something interesting about where the American voter is. Because the poll came out and said that, and the Washington Post asked, who will protect democracy the best? And I think the Post got a surprise when more people said Trump. Now, whether the correct answer is Trump or Harris doesn't matter to me. What I do find interesting is that you have this unrelenting campaign by Harris, by the media, and yet the public is not persuaded. Right. And this is just the latest example where it's clear the public isn't listening. That the media has been writing stories for itself and for their friends. I mean, you first write off half the country by getting into advocacy journalism, and then you write to an even smaller and smaller population of readers, and it's getting pretty incestuous. But I think the Washington Post CEO is correct. Nobody's reading your stuff anymore.
So do you see a role then, if you say social media, because of its importance and the sort of the democratization of freedom of the press to so many people, and you mentioned this in the book, but you say a little bit more about, do you see any role for regulation or what kind of regulation there should be of social media?
Well, you know, obviously I would prefer less regulation because I believe truly that good speech will overcome bad speech. I think that once you start to use things like disinformation as an excuse to regulate speech on the internet, you find yourself on this slippery slope. And we've seen where it heads. You know, we saw in the pandemic that there were many scientists that were silenced. I gave a speech at the University of Chicago, and many of them were sitting in the front row. These were people that signed the Great Barrington Declaration, other things. These are people who opposed, for example, the six-foot rule that the CDC recently admitted there was not really science behind that. I opposed the blue surgical masks as just having marginal, if any, benefit at all. I supported the idea of natural immunity, supported the idea of the lab theory of COVID. All of those views have been vindicated, and yet all of those views led to these people being being censored and throttled and blacklisted. And what it meant is that we didn't have a debate. People were harmed, right? We shut down businesses, we shut down schools, where in Europe, many countries did not do that. And they didn't experience those same harms. So I think that it's easy to say that we need censorship because we have to protect you from disinformation. But who makes that decision of what is disinformation and misinformation? And by the way, the third category, malinformation, is one of the three categories the Biden administration has said has to be subject to these efforts. Malinformation is defined as true facts that are used in a misleading way. Now, think about that for a second. How many times have you heard the government complain that people are making statements in a misleading way? To them, that is the equivalent of disinformation and misinformation. It shows the slippery slope that you're on once you allow the government and these companies to start to regulate our speech.
What do you say to people who are listeners who might be thinking, all right, but that means social media, speech, and press, a lot of hateful things are going to be published, for example, on X. What do you say to that?
Well, look, there is a lot of stuff on social media that is grotesque, that is wrong. And I don't mean to be misleading. When you believe in a robust free speech value, or values, you're going to have speech that you don't like. That's the test of free speech, is to fight for people who say things you don't like, even things that you find grotesque. Now, that doesn't mean that it's a free-for-all. You know, before we got into content moderation, this Orwellian term for censorship, we did remove some stuff. In fact, the anti-free speech movement constantly cites things that we always did remove, things like child pornography and fraudulent, you know, business practices. Those were always removed. So, yeah, there was content moderation in the sense that that was removed. But what we're really talking about is the vast majority of this other stuff, which is disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation. And that's where the social media companies are now playing this role. You have the European Union, that's now threatening Musk and saying, well, you must censor American citizens. And they took that step at the encouragement of people like Hillary Clinton. So after Musk bought Twitter, Hillary Clinton called on the Europeans and said, you need to force Musk to censor. Now, that's a former Democratic presidential nominee going to the Europeans and saying, you need to force him to censor American citizens. And yet our government, the Biden-Harris administration, Congress, has not said anything. You know, so when Europe comes in and engages in trade practices that affect our lives, Congress and the president are right there with potential retaliatory action. But when Europeans come in and say, we're going to force you to censor according to our standards, there's not an objection, even though this is the indispensable right. This is the thing that defines us.
The answer to that kind of speech, as you're suggesting, is some of it is can be removed because it's simply illegal. And then you've also argued the answer to bad speech is good speech and more good speech. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'm a big believer, and maybe I'm a dinosaur in this sense, but I do believe that good speech prevails over bad speech. What I do know, as I raise in the indispensable right, is point to a single censorship system that has ever worked. What's amazing about censorship systems, there's not one system in the history of the world that has stopped a single idea or a single movement. All it's done was to give governments control over speech, but they have never succeeded. Even the Chinese, with their so-called Great Wall for the internet, has not stopped information from getting to Chinese citizens. Now, they've certainly been successful in reducing it, but they haven't stopped it. And the result is that you have to ask yourself, about censorship is, what is it that you think you're going to achieve? Because in Germany, they have engaged in censorship since World War II in an extent that is probably unprecedented in Europe. They have massive neo-Nazi rallies, right? It hasn't affected the targeted population of skinheads and neo-Nazis. They seem to be doing just fine, unfortunately. But they have affected other citizens. Only 17% of German citizens say that they're comfortable expressing themselves in public.
Wow.
So they're silencing the wrong people. That's what censorship does. And so when we say good speech overcomes bad speech, it is certainly more successful than censorship. But the other thing is that people look at a minority of speech, of some of these extreme sites, right? Many of these people have 20 followers, right? But they get an oversized level of attention because they're filled with rage. what people don't notice is they're so focused on these rageful voices that the vast majority of the internet is not listening to those. Now, yeah, they'll get an enhanced level of attention because they cause such alarm. But you have to trust citizens more. I don't think that citizens are becoming extremists. I think that the best way to deal with extremists is to use free speech to shout them down. We protected Brandenburg, a horrible human being who was a KKK wizard, an anti-Semite, a racist. Everything that man said was horrible. But you don't solve that problem by silencing him. You solve that problem by allowing us to condemn what he is, what he's projecting into society. And that means we have to spend less time trying to silence people, which is the focus of much of what people do today, and spend more time responding to them and denouncing views that we view as hateful.
The book is there. It's tough. It's tough to read sometimes, Mel, because you speak some hard truths in here. You speak some things that are not pleasant to hear. It's grim many times, the picture that you portray, rightfully, accurately. But the question I think a lot of listeners have is, do you have any hope? The future of free speech and free press in the United States.
You know, I do have a lot of hope. It's strange because, look, this is an unvarnished history of our struggle with free speech. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've arrested a lot of people for political speech. The courts have not functioned the way they should.
And you even blame some of the American founders like John Adams.
Absolutely. But there's a certain optimism that comes from believing that free speech is a natural right. And that is, if some of us are right, that this is a natural right, that it's what makes us human, that we can't be fully human without it, there is a sense of optimism. Because it means that what the government's doing and this alliance with corporations, the media and academia, they can certainly reduce our appetite for free speech, but they really can't take away our taste for it because it's what makes us human. You can't destroy our desire for free speech without destroying us. So I truly believe that the anti-free speech movement today, which is the most dangerous movement in our history, is going to fail because it's in our DNA. We're hardwired for free speech. And yeah, I mean, this is an age of rage, but it's not the rage that defines us. It's free speech that defines us.
That's an important reminder and good grounds for hope. Jonathan Turley, again, the book is The Indispensable Right, Free Speech in an Age of Rage. Thanks for taking the time again to join us on The American Idea.
My great pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.